at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are going through Leviticus 25 through 27, wrapping up the book. The Lord spoke to Moshe at Mount Sinai and said, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you have come into the land which I give you, then the land shall have a Shabbat to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its crop. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Shabbat rest, a Shabbat to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. All of you shall have the Shabbat products of the land for food, yourself and for your female and male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you. Even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have its crops to eat. You are also to count off 7 Shabbats of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7 Shabbats of years, namely the 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound a horn throughout all your land. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a yobel for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. You shall have the 50th year as a yobel, and you shall not sow nor reap its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. It is a yobel. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. On this year of yobel, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the yobel you shall buy from your friend, he is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price, and in proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price. For it is a number of crops he is selling to you. So you shall not wrong one another. You shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments, so as to carry them out, that you may live securely on the land. Then the land will yield its produce, so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year, if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year, that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or in the case of a man who has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, so as to return his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of the Obel. But at the Obel it shall revert, and he may return to his property. Likewise, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it is not bought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to its purchaser throughout his generations. It does not revert in the Yobel. The houses of the villages, however, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Yobel. As for the cities of the Levi have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which are their possession. What therefore belongs to the Levi except what may be redeemed as a house sale in the possession, and the city of this possession reverts in the Yobel. For the houses of the cities of the Levi are their possession among the sons of Israel. But pasture fields of their cities shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Now in a case of a countryman of yours becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim, to give you the land of Canaan, and to be your God. If a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner, that he shall serve you until the year of the Yobel. He shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family, that he may return to the property of his forefathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out from the land of Mitzrayim. They are not to be sold in a slave sale. You shall not rule over him with severity, but you are to revere your God. As for your male and female slaves whom you have, you may acquire male and female slaves from the pagan nations that are around you. Then too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they will have produced in your land, they also may be your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive as a possession. You may use them as permanent slaves. But in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. Now, if the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have the redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him. Or, if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He then, with his purchaser, shall calculate from the year when he was sold himself to him up to the year of the Obel, and the price of his sale shall correspond to the number of years. It is like the days of a hired man, that he shall be with him. If there are still many years, then he shall refund part of his purchase price in proportion to them for his own redemption. And if a few years remain until the year of the Obel, he shall calculate with him. in proportion to his years, he is to refund the amount of his redemption. Like a man hired year after year, he shall be with him. You shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. Even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out at the year of the Obel, he and his sons with him. For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out from the land of Mitzrayim. I am the Lord your God. Chapter 26. You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it. For I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Shabbats and revere my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my judgments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their weight. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until the grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until the sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I shall also grant peace in the land, so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts in the land, and no sword will pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. Five of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000. And your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So I will turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because the new. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from the land of Mitzrayim so that you would not be their slaves, and I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commands, if instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat it up. I will set my face against you, so that you will be struck down before your enemies, and those who hate you will rule over you, and you will flee when no one is pursuing you. If also after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride of power, and I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. Your strength will be spent uselessly, for your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit. If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you 7 times according to your sins. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. And if by these things you have not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you. And I, even I, will strike you 7 times for your sins. I will bring about upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. And when you gather together in your cities, I will send pestilence among you, so that you will be delivered into enemy hands. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in 1 oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts, so that you will eat and not be satisfied. If in spite of this you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with wrathful hostility against you, and I, even I, will punish you 7 times for your sins. Further, You will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters you will eat. Then I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and heap your remains on the remains of your idols. For my soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities as well and will make your sanctuaries desolate. And I will not smell your soothing aromas. I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Then the land will enjoy its Shabbats all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. And the land will rest and enjoy its Shabbats. All the days of its desolation, it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Shabbats while you were living in it. As for those of you who may be left, I will also bring weakness into their hearts and into the lands of their enemies. And the sound of a driven leaf will chase them. And even when no one is pursuing, they will flee as though from the sword, and they will fall. They will therefore stumble over each other, as if running from the sword, though no one is pursuing, and you will have no strength to stand up before your enemies. But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' land will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of their enemies, and also because of the iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them. If they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness which they committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me, I also was acting with hostility against them to bring them into the land of their enemies. Or if their uncircumcised heart becomes humble, so that they then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Yaakov, and I will remember my covenant with Yitzhak, and my covenant with Abraham as well, and I will remember the land. For the land will be abandoned by them, and will make up for its Shabbats while it is made desolate without them. They meanwhile will be making amends for their iniquity, because they rejected my ordinances, and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them, nor will I so abhor them so as to destroy them, breaking my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Mitzrayim in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and ordinances which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moshe at Mount Sinai. Chapter 27. Again, the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to the valuations of persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is of the male, from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary. Or if it is a female, then your valuation shall be 30 shekels. If it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male shall be 20 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even up to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. If they are from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if he is poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means of the one who vowed. The priest shall value him. Now if it is an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering to the Lord, any such that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. Then He shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad, or bad for a good. Or if he does exchange animal for animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. If, however, it is any unclean animal of the kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest. And the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As you, the priest, value it, so it shall be. But if he should ever wish to redeem it, then he shall add one-fifth to it, your valuation. Now if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it as good or bad, and the priest, as the priest values it, so it shall stand. Yet if one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add one-fifth to your valuation price to it, so it may be his. Again, if a man consecrates the Lord part of the fields of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it, an omer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of the Yobel, according to your valuation, it shall stand. And if he consecrates his field after the Yobel, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him proportionate to the years that are left until the year of the Yobel, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. If the one who consecrates it should ever wish to redeem the field, then he shall add one-fifth to your valuation price, so it may pass to him. Yet, if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts in the Yobel, the field shall be holy to the Lord, like a field set apart. It shall be for the priest as his property. Or if he consecrates to the Lord a field which he has bought, which is not part of the field of his own property, then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of your valuation up to the year of the Yobel, and he shall give on that day and your valuation as holy to the Lord. In the year of the Yobel, the field shall return to the one from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs. However, a firstborn among animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may consecrate it, whether ox or sheep, it is the Lord's. But if it is among the unclean animals, then he shall redeem it according to your valuation, and add to it one-fifth of it. And if it is not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuation. Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart for the Lord out of all that he has, of man or animal or of the fields of his own property, shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction is most holy to the Lord. No one who has been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Thus, all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the tree, it is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his title, part of his tithe, he shall add to it one-fifth. For every tenth part of the herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. Or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moshe for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. So thus we come to the end of not only this passage, but of the book of Vayikra, or Leviticus. Now, before we get going too much further, any thoughts or observations before we get going too far? I guess we have a comment down here.
I thought the Levites weren't supposed to inherit a land, but it looks like they have a city set out and they have
a city
fields
set aside for them.
Okay, but they don't own it?
That is one of those things that doesn't revert to anybody else.
It's just theirs.
Yes, it okay. is theirs.
Then how come in the beginning somewhere, which I'm sure you'll know, they said that the Levites don't have an inheritance?
Inheritance as in a carved out, this is the state of Levi, or the tribal area of Levi. Like the other tribes all had their regions that they were designated and marked off, but Levi didn't. They were scattered among on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah, it was definitely an intent for them to be scattered among all of the places, which I guess when you see in the latter days of Yisrael before the big exile, especially the Assyrian exile, I guess you might say that was one of the lingering witnesses for the northern tribes, the ones of Levi who were there. Although, you know, there's some examples you see of people from the tribe of Levi who, I guess, you know, didn't remain as faithful to transmitting and teaching the word as they used to. So, yeah, we have a comment.
Was this
there.
Written on their hearts and minds at this time too, or no?
Written on their hearts and minds?
Like, you know how like in the New Testament it says like they'll be written on their hearts and minds? Do you think back then God didn't just share it with them, but he put it on their hearts and minds? Does it ever say that in the Word? Or?
One of the things that you might notice in there is in chapter 26, Leviticus 26. We'll talk about that, but it's a recurring thing that you keep seeing mentioned again and again. It depends on the translation, but it's talking about abhorring. And it's a big fancy word for hating. So it is an approach toward God which is hating what he says, hating his instructions. So that's one of those things, and it might seem almost, you might say, a little bit contradictory at the end of it, because it looks like first he's talking about, you know, smite, 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 curse, 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 and then at the end of it, it says basically, I'm going to pick up the pieces that are left over and bring them back. So it sounds kind of a bit odd, except if you lose track of what this whole work that we call Vayikra or Leviticus is all about. If you lose sight of that, then, you know, this seems kind of wanton and capricious, just seeming like heaven is passing out curses and blessings on a whim, but far from it. So it does get to exactly what you're referring to about being written on the heart. Because we'll see an example of one of these instructions related to especially freeing people during the sabbatical years, the Jubilee year, where that whole part of written on the heart was certainly not evident. Not evident. And we'll get into a little bit more related to the instructions of these redeeming things here, where it's heavily, heavily dependent upon what is written on the heart. And some of these, you could say, kind of excruciating details of how you value it and how we call it prorate the valuation, depending on the years before and after the Obel. It's all about what's written on the heart. So we'll be getting into that a little bit more. We have a comment down here first and then one over there. Yes.
Oh, okay. In 27... And it's talking about, you may not dedicate a firstborn animal to the Lord, for the firstborn cattle, sheep, and goats already belong to him. However, you may buy back the firstborn of a ceremonial, unclean animal by, you know, paying the priest. But it says, the unclean animal, you know, however, it says, especially set apart for the Lord, whether a person, an animal, or a family, or a property. So that saying a person could be considered an unclean animal, right?
Well, it's one of those things that, you know, categorically, yes, people are unclean.
Right.
But the talking about unclean animals specifically related to not human.
Yeah. Well, that's the nephesh. I was just wondering your take on that. I mean, so this is talking about something, but it's going back to the same thing is like the beginning of 27, it says you may not exchange or substitute another animal, neither a good animal for a bad one, or a bad animal for a good one. But if you do exchange one animal for another, then both the original animal and the substitute will be considered holy. If, yeah, that's in there. And it says, if your vow involves an unclean animal, one that is not acceptable as an offering to the Lord, then you must bring the animal to the priest. See, I mean, I have my own suspicions, but I'm just wondering.
Well, what's your suspicion?
Well, my suspicion is that before we become, I mean, the nephesh is the firstborn, I believe. And we can't offer that to God in the condition that we're in. So, you know, to become holy means we keep the commandments and follow him. And then he changes us and makes us acceptable and holy and clean, I'm thinking. And then we can come to him with the animal. But later on he says, if you can't even buy back another animal if it's already been destined for destruction.
Yeah, because you have to look at the two different topics that are different topics here. Even though they're in the same chapter, the wording for them is a little bit different.
We'll
get into that more when we talk about chapter 27. But the dedicating and the devoting over, they sound similar in English, but in Hebrew, you're referring to a vow. And basically something that is, you could say, condemned, I guess would be a better English term for it, versus, you know, it's the word in Hebrew with harem is, you know, you could say devoted to, but if what we're talking about here is, especially in how it's used a lot, is more, you could basically say condemned would be a better way to put it. So we'll get to that a little bit more. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's just grab this one over here, and then we'll get back to this. Louise, yes.
Well, in the beginning of 25, when he talked about that the land should have a Sabbath, and then he said that in verse 6, the Sabbath of the land shall be meat for you. It says don't pick it or don't glean it. And then another place, it seemed like it said you can't buy it, you can't sell it. But it sounds like they're able to eat from the stuff that grows wild, grows untended. Is that true?
Yeah. Yep.
They have to pick it in order to do that, though, right?
Well, what you're talking about, gleaning versus harvesting.
So the harvest is, you can't buy it like for a product. But your family can still eat what grows naturally without being planted.
Yep. That's what you get there with that.
And there's something about the animals, the increase in the animals, though, are still available to you, right? So it's something about them to being either for meat or that would be their meat. I'm not sure which way that goes.
Yeah, their food.
So it's okay that even though it's a Sabbath, the increase in the animals, they can eat those.
It'd be their food, yeah. Sometimes with the King James, when it says meat, it doesn't mean
meat. It means
meat.
Food, yeah.
It means food.
Yeah, so that's their food as well as everybody else's.
Yep. Yeah, it's basically, it's going to be let to grow as it will during that period.
But you don't have to let it fall on the ground and decay. You can harvest what you need for yourself.
It's basically, it's when we read early in Leviticus when it talked about, you know, don't harvest all the way out to the edges and don't, you know, go back around again after you go through once, meaning you leave those things for the poor. Well, during that, the year, the seventh year, the sabbatical year, it is, everybody's in that condition. Everybody is a gleaner, not just the people who are poor.
I thought that's what it meant.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Kind of very important reason for that, not just a functional agricultural reason, that's definitely a good reason for that. But Louise had a question over here. Yes.
Very just. God is very righteous. He designed everything so that the rich don't get very, very rich and the poor never get very, very poor.
Well, at least probably one way to address that slightly differently would be that those who do get rich better open their fist to those who don't have a lot. Because
one of the great lessons, we'll be getting to that a lot here with both the sabbatical year and the Jubilee, is remember where it all comes from. That's, I guess, would be the big underlying lesson. Remember where it all comes from. So if you end up getting a lot of it, just make sure that you remember that not just because of how fantastic you are, that it all came to you. So, any other last thoughts before we get going too much further? So, one of the things, since we are getting here to the end of Vayikra, is to basically take another look at where we came from. And remember when we started here in chapter 1, we started with this question, okay, the Lord is calling, because that's what Vayikra means, and He called. And remember where that calling was from. It was calling from inside the tabernacle. And He was calling to whom? To whom was He calling? Everybody was outside, because remember how Exodus ends? It ends with God moving in. Everybody had to get out. And then you start with the first part of that is how do you get back in? So as we looked at with kind of like the first seven chapters of Leviticus are about what? The korbanot, our great vocabulary here, korbanot, or with a Q. Korbanot. Remember what korban means? Means to that which draws near. So, draw near. So as we see that how Exodus ends with everybody getting out, and then beginning part, He's calling from the sanctuary. Well, how then do you go visit Him? Remember how we looked at when the times passed, we were looking at Leviticus 16 with talking about the Day of Atonement. And then we took a look through Hebrews 4 through 10, basically cementing this idea. You just don't waltz into God's presence on your own anytime you like, unless you have a calling card, unless you have an invitation, unless you have a way to get in. Because with God's presence in there, just you by yourself, no. That doesn't work. And we saw in Leviticus 10 that it worked quite tragically, where someone, the two sons of Aharon, were, it says, presenting strange fire or foreign fire. And you get the sense from the beginning part of Leviticus 16, where you just don't come talking to Aharon. It's like you don't come in anytime you like to. And then going on how Aharon comes in one day a year into the presence, direct presence of the Lord. So one of the things we've seen in like the first seven chapters is it keeps talking about the different types of korbanot and their offerings. And these offerings come in from the people and then get transformed via the altar and the washings, and the blood moves then closer in through the various offerings into the presence of the Lord. So you get this picture of the people are then being brought near into the presence of the Lord through the offerings. So one of the things that we have seen is that the tabernacle is really a great parable of how we move close. And, the Apostle Paul brings this out, and he talks about those who are far off being brought near. In that particular context, you're talking about people who, not associated with God previously, called Gentiles, God-fearers, people who are hearing God's voice and coming near, those who were far off now being brought near. But as we started out with Vayikra, everybody was far off. They were drawing near through a very specific process. And as we went through Hebrews, we get this cemented again and again and again, that all of the parable of the tabernacle, all of that parable of the tabernacle is talking about this is something real that's going on. This is a pattern of something that's going on. I was just hearing someone this week, you know, again, you've probably heard variations of it, but someone was saying, well, the ceremonial law that you see in the Old Testament was all about a way of righteousness, but people had to learn that that didn't work. So then we had to come up with the new covenant to show the way that really worked. But one of the things that we saw is, you recall we're going through Hebrews 4 through 10, was what? Pattern that was shown on the mountain, which is the tabernacle. The tabernacle is a pattern, copy of what Moshe saw on the mountain. It is not the actual thing. So one of the things that we learn throughout this process, the process of drawing near, has never, ever, 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 ever been about righteousness being bestowed this way, through this parable. Because, you know, that's like you read the parable of the Good Samaritan and suddenly you become a Good Samaritan. No. No, doesn't work that way. Parable is a lesson. And if you have a thick skull, like I know I do, then if the lesson doesn't get in, you didn't actually learn anything. So the only way to actually become a Good Samaritan is, you know, you hear it, you respond and realize, oh wow, okay, that's not my character. So how does my character have to go from where it is now to what is being taught like in the Good Samaritan? Well, what has to happen? That what has to happen, kind of what Elias was getting at there, is that having to write the laws on the heart. And we've seen that, you know, mentioned so many different ways throughout Leviticus, that there is a change that has to happen inside yourself. Because one of the big lessons you get throughout Vayikra is, wow, you are going to fall short. Remember how we were going through the... That's another kind of section, huge section of Leviticus. You know, it goes on, you know, after you got the talking about the institution of the priesthood from chapters, you know, 8 through 10, then from chapters 11 through 15 of Leviticus are talking about making the distinctions between clean and unclean. And when you go through, remember when we went through all those distinctions, it's like, wow. That happens just by being alive. You can become unclean. Just the way bodies work, you become unclean. So this is all about, okay, you know, becoming righteous and avoiding the uncleanness. Well, sorry. That's one of the great lessons of Vayikra is just being alive, it's not going to happen just by itself. So one of the big lessons of this is this righteousness does not come through Vayikra, doesn't come through Shemot or Exodus, doesn't come through Deuteronomy, doesn't come through Numbers, doesn't come through any of that. It's just like a parable. It comes through hearing it and understanding it. And that understanding, and it talks about above all things, get wisdom, get understanding. Not just knowledge, not just like, okay, yeah, here we are again. We're at the end of Vayikra, heard this last year, and the year before that, and the year before that, the year before that. Well, one of the things that these memorials should be kind of reminding us is that, yeah, we've been here before, but where have we actually come? Are we kind of like moving from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, to the land? Or are we just going around in circles? Out in the wilderness? Are we still out there doing our orbits around in the wilderness? Half and half.
Sometimes you go forward, sometimes...
Sometimes you go around, sometimes you go forward. But, you know, it's one of those things that the great lesson of all this is keep moving forward. You know, we hear a lot about moving forward, and that's kind of like moving past that old stuff that people taught long time ago, but to the new stuff and to the better stuff, the more relevant, the hip, the stuff that's now. But really, the progression is being far off from God toward God's presence. That is the moving forward, you know, and if we, our lives kind of going around and around and around like that, one of the things I hope we saw as we were going through Hebrews is that that's what we have, a great high priest. That's through the great high priest and that covering, we can have confidence to go in. Because, you know, the same scary verse that you see in chapter 10 when it says, if you keep on sinning, there's no longer any more sacrifice. And wow, that's pretty scary. But chapter 10, it also says that, you know, therefore we have confidence to boldly go into the presence of God. Why? Because you're so fantastic, just like Aharon's two sons who got barbecued? No. It's because it mentions there in that verse, of verse 19 of chapter 10 of Hebrews, because of the blood of Yeshua. That is what gets us in. It has always gotten us in. That's why in Revelation it talks about the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. It has always been the plan. That's always been the way it works. So as we go through this parable of not only the tabernacle, but the priesthood and the offerings, this is like, all right, we know now that we need a way in the door. We need to get in through the door and into God's presence. So you get up through chapter 16 of Leviticus and the Day of Atonement, and then it's like you get out the other side. Now it's the then what. And you know, after the then what, we saw all kinds of instructions about behavior. To remember, this was before, this was given before they were going to enter the land. So they were going into a place where the lifestyle was quite a bit different from what it was that God was intending. The lifestyle was quite a bit different. So thus, we get here to the end, and these last few chapters that we have about the seventh year, and then the cycles of the 7 years, and then the 50th year, the Yobel year, the proclamation of that. So, because we are working with the one whose thoughts are far beyond us and who's given us a little bit of glimpse into the understanding of how things work, what should we sort of get a little inkling of when looking at the Shemitah year and also the big old Shemitah year of the Yobel, so not only the seventh year, but also the 50th year, what picture should we get of that that fits in with the whole parable of the tabernacle and everything? Restoration, okay? Those who are far off being brought near. Now, what then do you see with these cycles? You got the cycles of the 7 year cycles, and then the seven times seven cycles, and so that then, yes, I did manage to make it through a little bit of grade school arithmetic. So you got 7 year cycles, and then there's seven of them. So what is it that we had seen as we were kind of chugging through Vayikra, and we also saw it a little bit in Shemot or Exodus, about seven, the number seven. Completion. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because you got some sort of things that are, you could say, somewhat corollaries to it. You got 7 days and 7 days Shabbat. So every 7 days you have a Shabbat, and then it's talking about the land having its Shabbat. So one of the things, what is it that the thing that gets emphasized with Shabbat? And you see it here as we are into 25. Yeah. Stop. More than just take a nap. This is stop. Stop. And it says, especially as we were going through Exodus, in chapter 20 there with the big 10, it's stop. You stop doing all the stuff to keep you alive because, you know, your daily toil. Because why? Because, you know, it goes right after Genesis 2. You stop because the Creator stopped. So, stop. Stop, stop, stop. Stop, stop, stop. And then, after you're stopping, then you stop. So, after you go past your 7 cycles of stopping, so it's a stop, stop, then you add the year at the end, and then stop, stop, stop. 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 And start over. Remember, one of the things that we had taken a look at with the pattern of Pesach and then the 7 days of matzot or unleavened bread. So you get Passover, 7 days of unleavened bread. You end up with your spilling over into the 8th thing. And then at the other end of the year, in the 7th year, just coincidentally, 7, the 7th month of the year, then you've got another cycle of 7 plus 8. And the 7 plus 8 is you've got Sukkot, 7 days of Sukkot, and the 8th day after that of the Shemini Atzeret, or the convocation or the meeting of the 8th day. So one of these pictures that we have, and you keep getting the circumcised of the newborns, on the newborn boys on the 8th day. And what are some other 8s we saw as we were chugging through Vayikra? 8s. Any remember 8s? And 8 times the sins are forgiven, 8 times the soothing aroma. And remember the priesthood? 7 days and the 8th day. Remember the called leprosy, the lepers? 7 days and then the 8th day. So we were talking about new beginnings, new beginnings, new beginnings, all over again. So it's kind of the interesting thing that you are going through all of, you got 7 years and then you stop. Stopping the agricultural activity. And then you have, you say, a mini Shemitah or a mini release. Then you go another 7, another release, another release. But really, it comes up on the Obel. You saw it mentioned again and again, both in 25 and Leviticus 25 and Leviticus 27 about the Obel factoring in, about this year of release. So it's you've gotten up to the 7 sevens, and then you go one beyond that into it. And just like where we're chugging through here during the time noted as the, you know, counting the Omer or counting up the harvest headed towards Shavuot or Pentecost, it's another 7 sevens plus 1. Coincidence, right? Absolute coincidence that you have 7 sevens plus 1. So, coming here at the end of Vayikra, the 7s, the 50s, this is teaching us about a time of release. One of the things I think is great is when you see, like, right at the beginning of chapter 25, and it says, verse 2, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you've come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Shabbat. the Lord. So, what is kind of the key thing in there? The key phrase about the Shabbat. What is the key phrase related to why this Shabbat? Have the Shabbat for the land. I give you the land. I give you. I gave you the land. Remember that. I gave you the land. I gave you the land.
Oh.
Yes. Well, that's one of those key things that, and we'll see it as we kind of move on a couple books later into Devarim or Deuteronomy, beginning part in we see it first off in chapter 4, verse 4. You know, and Messiah quotes it when he was encountered by the adversary: "As man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." So one of those big lessons that's coming through is the land he gives. So thus, when he says, stop, and then he even says in provision here, okay, you stop on the seventh year, then you're going to plant on the eighth year, and it's going to last over into the ninth year. Wow. So this is not just a one-year commitment here. When you're talking about an agricultural society, you're talking about a three-year commitment. Yeah, 7, 8, 9. You have to roll over through that period of time. So this is talking about faith for an agricultural society to say, okay, we're going to go on vacation for year 7. And then we're going to start seeing our first, you know, commercial crop, commercially ready crop and such in year 9. Wow. That takes faith. What sort of faith is involved with that?
Obedience.
But remembering where it comes from. Because what would convince you to just charge on, you know, continue on with your... you're harvesting right through years 7, 8, 9, and on you go. Trust you're going to take care of you. It's like, well, if I stop, then where's the food going to come from? If I stop, where's this going to come from? If I stop working this, my land, if I stop working my land and my crops, what's going to happen? Oh, no. Yeah, and we see this big description in chapter 25 of, okay, everybody is going to be then into this mode of gleaning. You know, you work the field, it's mine. Who are these people here coming in through my field, taking my stuff out of my field, my crops? Yeah, because the land is mine. You see that? And you see it emphasized again and again and again. Because the land is mine. Have you ever wondered why it is that you keep seeing this phrase after, you know, some pretty key phrases that we've seen in Vayikra so far? I am the Lord. We saw it especially after what we call the second greatest commandment. You know, love the Lord your God. Or, hello. That's the first one. The second one is, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. And it says, I am the Lord, and the end of it. Why do you do that? Because He is the Lord. Why do you stop with your agricultural activities? He's the one who gave you the land. Yeah, it was kind of interesting this week. There was a research paper that came out completely from a secular standpoint, but very interesting, talking about that the lots and lots of chatter. Lots and lots of chatter at the microbe level. Microbes are chattering all the time. And one of the things they've been realizing in recent years is you might have heard, you know, like when you go and you get paint and they say, I want to get a low or no VOC paint. Have you ever seen low or no VOC paint? You know, volatile organic compound paint. Basically, it's the stinky stuff. If you want paint that really just has a stench, You know, you go for the just regular, and the ones that have limited VOCs or no VOCs, those are the kinds, you know, they smell like a liver a little bit, and, but it's really pretty much gone. I know when we did Tammy's office, we did the no VOC paint, and that was amazing because, you know, within a couple hours, you couldn't even smell it anymore. But in the micro world, they communicate by VOCs. And it's really quite interesting is that they were specifically looking at bacteria and fungus. They talk to each other. One releases a VOC and the other one picks it up and responds. Sometimes they move closer to each other. Sometimes they move and process nutrients back and forth. We always talk about, like with one of the reasons we talk about crop rotation and such is why? Don't deplete the soil. What is it you deplete in the soil? Well, nutrients and stuff like that. Well, what gets the nutrients and stuff into the soil? Those little bugs. Bacteria, the fungus, stuff in there, the parasites down there, they is a whole big happy family of different types of fungus and parasites and bacteria and insects and such, and they will process, break one thing down into others, and even with plants, you need to have something that can take the stuff in the dirt, minerals and such, and move it into the roots so they can actually do something with it. So there's a lot of this communications through these VOCs that happens in the microbe world. One, what does this have to do with anything? Well, one of the things that we should note about why the Lord says, the land is mine. He's the one who created, you know, the great, you know, internet of bugs, the great internet of microbes. That's talking to each other and processing things and saying we need this, we need that, back and forth between them. So one of the things that we see in here is that we're not just talking about with some local deity that decides, hey, we want you to bring your crops in this this particular year. We want more crops. The priesthood, you know, they need to fill their barns, so they call for everybody to bring their stuff in. You're talking about the creator of heaven and earth, the dirt, the microbes, the bugs, the plants, people, all of that is saying, stop. Trust me. Have faith in me. Have faith that when I say, things will revert back to where they were before, that things will be okay. Things will be okay because of that. That is actually a good plan. Now, one of the things you might say is, we've seen this kind of thing happen before. Like, for example, what we're studying here in Leviticus 25 is really what you could say is like a ground lease today. It was a ground lease. You're really leasing your land, especially if it's changing hands between people, for a certain amount of time. And at the end of your term of your lease, then it goes back to the holder of it. See, that happens in, you know, in China is particular, has leases. You don't own the land. It is not yours. You get a lease from the government that you can use the land. And think of Hong Kong. Hong Kong was under a lease, and it decided to have that come up and reverted back. So with this situation, well, we see what happens now. We see it can get abused, where you have people who will, you know, either they will take advantage of people when they come to the end of their terms. You hear that all the time, especially if you know anybody who's involved in like business. When when you're dealing with perhaps an unscrupulous tenant or an unscrupulous landlord, and you're getting to the end of a term, and they need to renew, then they'll start turning the screws to you, or something like that. And you say, ah, that doesn't work. How can you have faith when somebody's saying to like give up your livelihood for a year and such? Well, that's one of the things where you could say a deviation from how things were originally planned for them to go. And it gets back to what Elias was talking about. the law written upon your hearts. We'll see in these provisions here about, okay, yeah, someone can go in there and they can glean. You know, don't take advantage of people depending on how many years after or before the years of release there are. Don't take advantage of people. They keep saying, you know, remember whose land this is. Remember who the people are. Yes, that's right. What you're selling is a series of crops. So you could say that's like a ground lease. But what is one of the things that we could say with a idea of a ground lease? On the good side, it allows circulation of property. Now you could say that being a kind of a good idea that land property gets to circulate around. It's not held captive by one particular owner, and they can just own it for in perpetuity. Well, the other side of that is that it could be that the controlling authority doesn't want you to have it. It belongs to everybody. So you don't get to have that stuff. So thus, you don't allow them to have it. Well, one of the things that is a hallmark really of a free society is the ability to say, that is yours. Because one of the things that we see in the Torah is, and it might sound like a strange thing among the instructions, do not move your boundary stones. Don't move, well, what does it matter? It's all shared land, everybody free, everybody goes free. Come in, grab the stuff, grab as much as you want. And everything. Well, if this is just a kind of a leased land society, then what does it matter really about boundary stones? That's somebody's property. This is somebody else's property. What does it matter about stealing someone's property or not? What does it matter? It dishonors what? This dishonors God. Yeah, it dishonors God by when He sets boundaries and such that we don't cross over them. But, you know, it's one of those other things, you know, we could say on, you know, perhaps the more cynical side, we could say, well, what is it, fences make good neighbors, or I forget how that is, you know. But that's one of those things that you establish boundaries between, you could say, boundaries of property. But one of those things, and it really goes back to what Elias said again, is the laws written upon your hearts. Things get drawn out boundaries if you cross over it and your heart is truly toward respecting someone else's property and their heart is toward respecting yours. Like, oops, I got over your property. I'm sorry. The other guy says, oops, yeah, you went over your property. You didn't mean it. You didn't mean to cross over and violate my property. I didn't mean to cross over and violate your property. And it goes back and things are fine. Where does the tension then come in? When someone repeatedly steps over and is like, what is this line here for? What is your boundary line? Are you trying to keep me out of your property? You know, I want to just go there. One of the things that we have challenges today with when we talk about property boundaries are hikers. And I have to admit, I did this when I was younger too, is, you know, you just think, I'm going to go on this path and this path goes on. And what's that fence? Or, you know, you step over the fence or it's got a hole in the fence. You go through the fence and you just keep going through. And then, you know, your dog comes barking or someone comes, arr, arr, and this and that. Well, it's one of those things of realizing where yourself stops, the other person begins. And realizing that both of you actually have to have a relationship. Now, and I was young and foolish and out there roaming around and didn't know any better. I was going around and one of my favorite things to do is all those fantastic swords. Those wooden swords that the contractors, they just plant those swords all over the place. It's amazing. And they even paint them pretty bright colors, neon orange. They draw on them, and oh, it was a great fun. Pull those things up and just have sword fights all the time. Oh, why are those angry, big angry men come chasing us all the time? You know, you just don't know that there are the boundaries that you're just not supposed to go across. Respecting, first, recognizing that that stick with something written on it is actually a whole lot of hard work that went into putting those things into those particular places. But then also realizing what those things represent. So when we go through like Vayikra, we're seeing like lots of boundaries. We're seeing here, especially when we're talking about the boundaries of the tabernacle, these are like the surveyor sticks. And one of those things was actually, you know, teaching yourself and your children, hey, you know, just don't waltz right in there. That curtain around the outside and those poles and everything, that means something. That's a special place. So when you're talking about coming back to the sabbatical years and the Obel, what is a special boundary that everybody has? Oh, they all get their land back, okay. But closer to home. In fact, very close to home. Us are who we are, people. So one of those, the key things in there is the discharge of people out. And they is this big point about the distinctions between the native born and the slaves and such like that. And one of those things you're like, well, where did the slaves come from? It mentions in there about from the pagan nations and such. Well, again, based on what the model is supposed to be, this is supposed to be what, Exodus 19, the kingdom of priests, right? The kingdom of priests with the laws of God, the testimony of the creator of heaven and earth. We've got the dwelling place of the presence of the creator of heaven and earth. This is supposed to be transmitting out into the world the presence and testimony who the creator of heaven and earth is. So thus, when we read later on about Israel going into the land and taking over, and in some places we read, like in Joshua, that some were, like it mentions toward the end of chapter 27 of Leviticus, that some were harem, the things inside of Jericho were harem. They were devoted. They were condemned, is a better way to put it. They were condemned. So some people can be harem to good uses. Like, for example, you could say that's the prophet Samuel, was devoted wholly over to a good purpose. His life was to be a fantastic mouthpiece and representation of God here to the people. But with Jericho, what was its devotion to? Devotion to destruction. But we also see in that, remember the thing about the cord?
Yeah, Rahab.
That's right. Rahab, that was a testimony. Because remember what she said to those spies. Remember that we read just a little snippet earlier, and we'll see more of them as we move into the next book, about the spies going into the land.
Yeah.
Remember her, but what did she remember? She remembered, and they all had heard about that the Lord was with Israel, and Israel was coming up to their gates. So, remember we were going through Hebrews 4 through 10? What is one of the key things you see there right at the beginning of chapter 4 of Hebrews? He's declared a day, and he calls it what? Today. Hear his word. And there remains a Shabbat rest. If you want to enter it, you want to enter the rest, or you want to shut your gates, post more guards, and hope that the power of the Lord doesn't overcome your defenses. Hope that the creator of heaven and earth is not stopped by, you know, a mound of dirt that you have around your city. So that's one of those things that all of us are faced with when we have our today. We're faced with, you know, are we going to go in and lock our doors, try to keep the Lord out? Or are we going to say, hey, God is with you. Have mercy on us. Take us in. Save us. Give us salvation. So you see, Rahab gets salvation. And gets more so than that, gets included into a line, a very prominent line and prominent descendants that come from her. So, as we see these two here, two, you know, you like Ezekiel, the wheels within wheels within wheels. That's really what the times of stopping are. The Shemitah means release. So we have the sevens, the times of release. You've got the 50 with its release, which sets up then chapter 26 of Leviticus. Well, what's chapter 26 all about? Yeah. For whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Yes. I guess you might be a little subtext you might put on chapter 26. Consequences of disobedience. Requirements of obedience. Consequences of disobedience. Blessings and curses. And we see this, and you know, as we get on into the next two books, you'll see these common formulas of blessings and curses. And, you know, frankly, this was a common thing that you'll see in other literature of the same time period of basically you seal the book with, this is what good will come out of this, this is what bad will come out of this. And actually, you know, we think, well, okay, that was just a relic of literature of the time period. But I know that all of us love to just look at like our loan documents when you get a mortgage on a house or, you know, credit card or something like that. You love to just sit down with some coffee or some tea and just love to just get out your magnifying glass and pour over all that fine print at the back of your contract. You know, the part that right before the little line at the end where you sign your life away, that part there, and you like to look into. Those are kind of, you'd say, modifications of the blessings and curses. It talks about your rights and stuff. Those are your blessings. And it talks about, yeah, the hammer's going to fall if you decide to do something else. So, in reality, what you're seeing in, you know, in Revelation or here in Leviticus or Deuteronomy with these ends of the book, it's not any different from any kind of a relationship. I mean, yeah, you probably don't sit down with your friend and say, hey, you know, we can go have lunch together and do all this kind of stuff, but boy, if you turn on me, look out. This is exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to unfriend you on Facebook. I'm going to, you know, and you're cursing and cursing and cursing and cursing and cursing. Well, it's really about a relationship. It's spelled out in excruciating detail here. But it's really about the realities of a relationship. But what are some of the things that we kind of noted this at the outset? What are some strange things about these blessings and curses that you've noted? So in the midst of all this, you know, smiting and chasing and lowering the boom and such, in the midst of, you know, comments like, my soul will abhor you, then it talks about, if you confess, in verse 40, if you confess your iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers, their uncleanness against me, which they've committed against me, and they're acting with hostility against me. You're asking about, well, where is this all about? This is not just, oops, I forgot, or oops, I wasn't paying attention. This is acting with hostility toward the Lord. Acting with hostility toward. One of the things that, you know, we've talked a number of times about with the abomination of desolation, you see that mentioned in the book of Daniel. You see that mentioned in Matthew 25 and 24, actually, when it talks about the abomination of desolation. And one of the things we've talked a number of times about is that this is something that the Lord brings upon His house. He gave Moshe this pattern on Sinai about where His presence was going to be, told him to build it. But from time to time, like in Shiloh, and then when it moves up to Jerusalem, He leaves it desolate, lets it get torn down, lets it get destroyed. Why does that keep happening? Well, one of the things that we see is mentioned here. Remember that we're talking about acting with hostility against. What does acting with hostility against God mean? Stiff-necked and rebellious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of interesting. She mentioned, you know, oh, yeah, we'll go with you. Now, do you see why these things about the vows that you see in chapter 27 are mentioned about? You know, vow this and, you know, put the values on this. And then you see that Yeshua talks about in chapter 5 of Matthew, it's like, you know, you've heard it said from days of old, you know, make sure that you fulfill your vows, don't make false vows. But I tell you, don't make any vows, don't make any oaths at all. Because, you know, if you're taking an oath by the altar or the seats of Yerushalayim, hey, these are, like it talks about, this is the footstool of the Creator of heaven and earth. Do you own the footstool? Because what are vows and oaths? What is a vow? Both of them are promises. Vows, it talks about make sure you pay your vows. Vows are like a promise with to show your earnestness. You are, you know, in 27, it talks about the valuation of all of these vows. And, you know, depending on who the person is, how much the value is. Now, that's showing your devotion because I'm going to vow this much. It's all about your earnestness and wanting to approach God. You're making this promise. And you also then have the oaths. We have a comment down here. We also have the oaths, and the oaths are another type of promise. But what is the added component of an oath?
Is that kind of what Peter did when he paid for another man to do? They were doing vows. Is that what you're
like,
talking
about?
Oh, like,
you know, well, when are you thinking of Yeshua with the tax?
No. Was it?
Oh, okay. Are you talking about with Paul?
No, he didn't. No. That was the guy that fell asleep in the window.
The guy?
The people were telling, I think it was Saul. And he took a. They were doing a vow.
Oh, right. He was supposed to go with
else.
The. He was supposed to, like in chapter 21 of Acts, I believe, isn't it? Where, you know, there was obviously the fervor of what Paul was teaching, and so the leaders of the Jerusalem Council said, "Hey, look, let's put all this stuff to rest, you know, and show them that really you are, you know, zealous for the law and such." Hey, we've got these. I think it was four of them, weren't they? Four that were fulfilling a vow, and most likely when you see the length of it and such, it was most likely a Nazarite vow. And so it's basically pay their way, pay their expenses, and you know, it looks like he actually was going and sitting with them through it and go through this process with them to basically show that. Now he's talking about like a Nazirite vow. Yeah, that is you are giving yourself over in service. And we see these other vows of the values of people and such, but the distinction where with vows and oaths, the oaths is like you're making a promise, but you are promising to do something and having someone put credence in the promise that you're making based on the authority of some other thing. You know, Yeshua gives the examples of swearing by the temple, swearing by, you know, Yerushalayim. And he also quotes in there from a passage where it talks about, you know, do not make false oaths. And it basically says, do not swear falsely by my name. So basically you're now saying, you know, some people will make invocations like, you know, as heaven is my witness or something like that. Or you'll see a common thing is they'll just throw out, I swear to God. Well, what is it that you're actually doing there? Oaths? Yeah, well, collateral, it's more like a cosigner. It's worse than collateral. You're basically dragging the creator of heaven and earth as a cosigner in whatever you're doing. Well, you think a smart cosigner is what? A cosigner on a loan or something like that? What is a smart cosigner? Well, it says no. Yes. The smart thing to do if anyone says cosign on this, say no. That's pretty much in most cases, that's a good idea. But a smart cosigner and perhaps a reasonable thing with a reliable payer, then the cosigner really should be like, hey, you look at it, I agree with you, go for it. Well, with basically dragging in the creator of heaven and earth as your cosigner on whatever it is you're making an oath on, you're saying, hey, heaven agrees with me on this. Heaven is in agreement on this. Well, how is it that you know? How do you know that heaven is in agreement? Do you have the authority to say, are you like an actual ambassador for heaven and say, basically declare, hey, heaven is on my side and saying this is this and this is that. That's why, you know, Yeshua just said, hey, let your yes be yes and your no be no, because you're going to drag heaven into making your statement any more believable or not. Your statement should be believable based on what? Your character. Not just your word that when, you know, you say yes, yes, no, no, that it actually means something. You know, the old saw, you know, your word is your bond comes into play here, is that you are known for actually following through with what you do. And that's why, you know, you got the prescription in the Torah where it says, you know, if you don't take a vow, you may be better off for it. It's no big skin if you don't take a vow. But if you do take a vow, look out if you don't follow through with it. And if you change your mind, wow. You see, the bill goes up. You add 1/5 to it. Add 20% onto it. Wow. Imagine a loan with 20% interest. Yeah, how would you like a mortgage with 20% interest on it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's like... like for a credit card, yeah, that's actually maybe getting off good on a credit card. But that's why it's one of those things. If you decide you're going to do something, if you decide you're going to make a promise, be very careful what you make promises toward. And you know, in Acts, you see the example of Aeneas and Sapphira. They make this promise. We gave it all. We sold it, and here's the money. And like, is this all of it? This is all of it. Well, yeah, if you're devoting it over, you are giving it, and you are representing what? That you sold this and I'm giving this to you. Well, that's one of those things that you just have to be extremely careful about what you devote yourself to. Now, it's one thing that when Yeshua used the parable of someone building a tower and counting the cost. Okay, if you go into it knowing that I am devoting myself over to the Lord and it's going to cost my life. Our brothers and sisters right now over in the Middle East, when they say and let it be known, they are not hiding it at all, that they are believers in the Creator of heaven and earth, the God of Israel. And they are believers in Yeshua as the Messiah of God. Yeah, that's could be a death sentence, and often is a death sentence. But you go into that knowing what the cost is. So, one of the, I guess you could see is, well, one thing not like the other. All of these things that we've seen throughout Vayikra are all about moving closer to God. And in the process of moving closer to God, we should be moving closer to other people. Moving closer to other people in our sincerity and truth. I think I heard those terms used somewhere before related to unleavened and what is it that is offered? Take big old poofy bread, throw it, and use that as the offering? No, unleavened bread. Our relationships with the Creator of heaven and earth has to be sincere, transparent. There's no mask we put on. Because remember, as we've seen throughout the prophets, God is not fooled by our act. Not fooled at all by any act that we put on. We may fool other people, but oftentimes, if you really look at it, people can tell if it's an act, if it's a put-on job. So, as we move closer to God, moving closer to each other. But some of those things amongst all of those blessings and curses that you see in Leviticus 26, there's a couple of really key points. We've talked a lot about one of the things that is important about having this tabernacle, God's presence, in the smack dab in the middle of the camp with all of them around there is what? Why was it smack dab in the middle? It says, I want my dwelling to be among mankind. I want to dwell with mankind. It's the memorial that we is commemorated with Sukkot, and we see that also emphasized in the book of Revelation. That's how that ends, the end of the story. Dwelling place with mankind. And I love it in here where it talks about, I will walk amongst you. People from long, long ago, sages have noticed that. What does that sound like? I will walk among you. Adam and Eve in the garden. Sounds like Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. That isn't that just a beautiful thing that the Creator of heaven and earth would be walking amongst us? Going from acting with hostility against me to walking amongst us. That is just a beautiful thing. And hopefully that when we see as we come to the end of Vayikra, that is the ultimate goal. That's where God is moving things toward. This isn't a giant amount of busy work and, secret handshakes for your club meetings. This is about moving closer to God's presence and in the process, building our relationships with each other so that more who are far off will be brought near by the blood of Yeshua. Amen. So, any last thoughts as we... Oh, I'm sorry, he's been hanging out there.
Thank you. I just found it kind of interesting. You brought up 40 in chapter 26. And when we read that, it starts out in 40, it says, if they confess their iniquities, and then it talks about their acting hostility against me. But what's amazing to me is in 41, he does the same thing back by him saying, I also was acting with hostility against them. So in other words, as they ask for forgiveness, he is forgiving also and, you know, giving, I mean, it's a back and forth. And the same thing as we go in a little farther, he says that if their uncircumcised heart becomes humble so that they make amends for their iniquity, and then he goes on and he makes amends right back by saying, and I will remember the covenant with Jacob, and I will remember with Abraham. And yeah. So it's just amazing to me how there's that back and forth there.
Yeah, because what was one of the things that Yochanan was saying is he was baptizing people. Show the works in keeping with the forgiveness of sins. It's like, the Lord is there. Come on. Come over. Get washed. But as part of that, show that this is something that's more than just, you know, washing dirt off your skin. Then we're actually cleansing you the inside. Kind of what has been prophesied throughout time, that there would be this water that would flow out from Sion and cleanse the nations. Starting, you know, first with the house of God, cleaning that up, and then flowing out into the nations to clean all that up. So that's one of those things where you see these in the midst of the blessings and curses. It's kind of similar to what you see with the, you know, extended parable love song you see in Song of Solomon, where it's like that tug, push, tug, push, tug, push. You see that between those two, between the beloved and the object of the beloved's devotion. So, oh, yes, we have.
So now we don't have a land to practice all of this. So now, are we at the point where we're doing this individually? Because, you know, stores are open and everything's functioning. We're not in a city with, you know, Israel, perhaps part of it, I imagine. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that, you know, sages have noted from long ago, and you could say, well, okay, maybe it's just their interpretation or not, but the idea is that this hasn't been practiced since the time of the Assyrian exile, because one of the ideas is that this is something where the whole family has to be there for things to go back to each other. Well, where is it going to go back to? You've got 10 tribes that are gone. Where is their property going to return to? This is something that you can see is truly its fulfillment in the Messianic era.
Yeah.
The time when Messiah is going to set things right.
So that's what it means. So that we're practicing so that when we live in the 1,000 years, we're going to know the law because it'll be written in our heart, and we'll be able to act it out, because here in 2017... We learn the commandments, right?
So when these things are coming up about, you know, the discharging your debts and people who are under debt to you and you're under debt to them, and discharging and letting those things go, it's a practice that we can have now, even though we don't have the, you know, particular agricultural cycle of that in particular. Yes, you know, like, for example, we are in the, you know, it's been determined to be the Yobel year, and so we're cruising through that right now. So we can do that with the, you know, talking about the land and those who want to abide by it, but until everything is totally restored, the total fulfillment of it can't be done. So We're left with, well, do we only have to forgive people and discharge their debts if we're a farmer? No. One of those things that we can learn from the instructions to farmers is it's a good lesson to let things go, to discharge, let those. It's really quite interesting that when the Messiah says to Peter, well, how much do we have to forgive? Seven times? Just seven cycle? No. Seven times seven. Or some cases, some translations, 70 times seven. So this is like, you've got to go full load to a full, complete restoration, discharge of all the debts. Not just like a little mini Shemitah. You've got to go the full Shemitah. That's right. So, any last thoughts as we close out here? All right, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for discharging the debts that have been against us. We thank you for taking us into your presence through the blood of your Son Yeshua. We thank you for setting him up as high priest, fully aware of the struggles that we go with. And Father, we thank you for having mercy on us, for showing us what comes from running away from you and pushing you away, but calling to us to come closer to you. We thank you for making this all possible through your Son Yeshua. We thank you in his name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.